Good evening and welcome to Term 5, Session 2 of the Five Megillashir. And last time we finished the 8th Perek of Megillas Esther. It's big stuff. Now remember, we've done a lot of groundwork here, a lot of groundwork. And we're now, for the 9th Perek, cashing in on all the work that we've done to make sure that we kind of tie up all loose ends, especially that we've done through the 8th, 7th, 6th and 5th Prokim, where everything essentially now is happening all at once with the Jews rising up against their enemies. And tonight, please God, we are going to cut into the 9th Perek. And we're going to take essentially very large chunks of Psukim, very large chunks. So for instance, in the beginning, I want to take 3 Psukim at a time, maybe 7, 8, 9 Psukim at a time. And then we'll kind of correlate what we've learnt with how those Psukim play out in the 9th Perek. But before we start the 9th Perek, I'd like to share with you a Rabbi Aaron Kotler on the Mishnas Rev Aaron in the 3rd Perek, and it's point 81 that he brings. And there's an associated Anaf Yosef, which is a commentary on the 8th Yosef, which is a commentary of itself on the Medrash Esther Rabbah. And that's actually in Parsha, the very, very end of the 10th Ois Yud, of the 10th Parsha of Esther Rabbah, which is where they are now sending out the letters at Mordechai's behest. And the Anaf Yosef says, who's on the 8th Yosef, who's on the Medrash Rabbah, so it's a super, super commentary. Maybe you call that a mega commentary, because it's beyond super commentary, and it's a commentary, it's a super commentary, I don't know what to tell you. So he says that Hashem's hand saved his nation from their attackers throughout history. So what's so big about Purim? It isn't the first time that Hashem has stepped in to save Klal Yisrael. And he's often dealt very harshly with the enemy. At the same time, I think probably most poignantly, with the Sea of Reeds, the splitting of Yamsuf, Kriyas Yamsuf, where each Egyptian was knocked about depending upon how evil they were. And each one knew that they were getting knocked about harder because they deserved it. But he drowned them all, except for Parah himself, who watched the whole thing from afar. However, says the Anaf Yosef, and this is really important, in no other situation in history up until this point do we ever find that the Jews were instructed by a Gentile decree to wreak vengeance upon their own enemies as they pleased. We've never seen in Jewish history God intervene to get the Goyim to tell the Yidden to raise up against your Goyish enemies. We don't see that. We had never seen that before. God had never manifested himself in that manner. Usually he steps in and he destroys that host nation through whatever calamity or political destruction it is. He wipes out Greece, you know, Babylon, Rome, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Chaldea. That's just how he does business. He completely destroys nations. In fact, people don't even know what Chaldea is. In Daniel, God says, I hate Chaldea so much. I don't want people to remember Chaldea. Chaldea was a bigger empire than Rome. Most people haven't even heard of Chaldea. Nebuchadnezzar was Chaldean. He was Chaldean. They were more powerful than the Romans, but God loathed them so much, some wiping their memory out from humanity. That's God doing it. Never do we see God turning around to the Goyim and saying, right, you promote the Jews to kill the Goyim. We don't see that. That's an unbelievable salvation. Now, you could, of course, you know, whittle that away as some kind of political UN government. No, this was absolutely clearly God's hand getting the Gentiles, Ahasuerus, to say to the Jews, you rise up against the enemies that threatened you and you kill them, and I'll rubber stamp it. I'll give that the signet ring. I'll give it the punch of the signet ring. You can go do as you please with them. We've never seen that before in our history, ever. I don't know if we've seen it since. Yes, you can say when the Russians and the Americans liberated the camps, I heard that they said, if there's anyone here, that has done you any wrong, do what you want and we'll turn a blind eye. But that is on a very, very limited scenario to some people who happen to be that. We're not talking about the whole nation of Israel being allowed to raise up and kill all the Germans at the actual Gentiles' decree of doing so. That's very important. So on this point, Rabbi Aaron Kotler in the Mishnas Rev Aaron says as follows. He says, it's like this. It's true that the Purim salvation did not include any openly miraculous events. There was no change in nature. God didn't, you know, turn water to stone or stone to water as he did for 40 years in the desert. No supernatural phenomena were evident except for the scepter extending, which was a completely, that was a supernatural phenomena. How long it had extended by, we had five different opinions as to what the distance was, and each one of those alludes to what it was that was the merit that Klal Yisrael was saved in. We did that at the time, go back and listen to that. But apart from that, there was no obvious delivery from bondage like there was in Egypt. And God had performed open miracles for his nation in other times, including the 10 plagues and most notably the splitting of the sea. On the way out of Egypt and entering the land of Eretz Israel, there were umpteen miracles. Some were daily. And in the defeat of Sanherib and his army, 180,000 soldiers died in a single night, being slaughtered by the archangel Gabriel. That was then Nebuchadnezzar saw that because he was the chief of staff for Sanherib. And when the archangel, that same archangel, saved Daniel's friends, Hanan, Mishael, and Azariah from the furnace, he recognized that same angel. He goes, that's the same one! Right, that's obviously miraculous. But the miracle of Purim contained no openly miraculous event apart from the extending of the scepter of Ahasuerus to Queen Esther. And that's not so, it is miraculous, but it wasn't such a public miracle that everyone saw it. That was something that only the chamberlains, Ahasuerus and Esther, were privy to. But in the miracle of Purim, if you think about it, each link in the chain of events added another natural explanation as to how Mordechai and Esther got away with it. And this very long chain and all of its various components could only be described as miraculous by any unprejudiced mind. Never before had the Jews, without land or protector, cowered before a majority of 127 provinces across a vast empire facing certain annihilation, and never before had an inexplicable turn of events caused those countless enemies to tremble before those who were exiled among them, even to the extent they were pretending to be Jews and dressing up as Jews. And it was a minority of Jews who rose to defeat and dominate them, and as we'll learn tonight, slaughtered 75,000 of them in one day. The Jews rose up and killed 75,000 Gentiles, that's no mean number, in 24 hours. And then Esther, as we'll learn, asked for another day's grace to do it again, which is really bizarre. And Ahasuerus said, okay, you can do it again. That's bizarre. We're going to have to ask what's going on there in the Pesukim. Even though God's face was hidden, says Rabbi Aaron Kotler, he certainly wasn't. This whole thing really happened in a 72-hour framework. From the second party, all going around, the whole thing turned about in 72 hours, in those 3 days. From one day of the fasting, 2 days of the partying, the whole thing turned around. The divine orchestration of nature and human events was clear for all to see, and every common and natural event had now become an eternal monument to God himself, even though he didn't reveal himself openly. It is that clear. That's the specialness of Purim. Now, I remember giving this over in my tefillah shir for those that I was meritorious enough to give over the tefillah shir to. We said a very important thing. In Shana Rishona, it happens to be my anniversary tonight. It's my 20th anniversary tonight. And I remember looking back, Shana Rishona is a very different time. And when you're in Shana Rishona, I'm just going to tell you like a... if you don't mind, I don't have the bell, but I'm going to hit the bell, bing, and go off a bit. Sometimes when you go out or something and you see people who've been married a very long time, they tend not to talk very much to each other. And that's because they don't have as much to talk about as a newlywed couple, which just don't stop talking to each other. here's the mashal, and we said this over during the Tefillah Shir as well, I think in the Bracha of Moedim. In the beginning of a relationship, it's very, very important that the Chassan and Kala talk to each other a lot to find out who they are so they can get on. And that takes time over that first year. Indeed, God, in last week's Parsha, he gives a year of duty off for the man to be able to stay at home, gladden his wife, make sure that they're a good functioning unit before he gets on with standard civic duty, such as going to the army. And after that, the talking kind of dies down a bit. And the reason is because you've said over the period of a few years, most of what you're going to say, then just get on with life. The relationship between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself as a wife and a husband respectively is similar. In the beginning of our courtship with God, he had a lot to tell us about himself and he showed his supernatural power many, many times in the beginning of our relationship. But Purim was a turnaround. From there on in, we don't need to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu so openly manifesting as 10 plagues and splitting of the sea to know that he's there, because we've seen that for a couple of thousand years. You know what? Our relationship has now progressed and developed and been promoted to a new stage where there's not as much open talk. A very experienced couple can just motion to each other with very slight non-verbal communication and they've said volumes. So too, Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu have entered a new level of relationship where God doesn't need to bend nature in order for us to know that he's there. He's shown us through Purim and things like that since that he's just as available there as he was at the time of the splitting of the sea. Just he manifests very differently. It's not as openly a talkative relationship. That doesn't mean it's any less deep, profound and communicative. It just isn't as verbal. And that's what's going on with the Purim turnover. This Purim, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after he made Purim, we know no more open miracles until Mashiach. We know that. No more global splittings of the sea. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that the Purim changeover, where you've accepted the Torah Shebaal Peh and the Torah completely properly at this stage, we're now on a new level of our relationship. You don't need to have mountains suspended above your head. It's not necessary. We're on a decent level. I don't need to speak to you like that. Now we can speak more obliquely and quietly, and we can just get on with our relationship. And that's what's happening at Purim. It's an extremely important point. And with that as a backdrop, let us now cut in, Be'ez Hashem, to the ninth parak, which essentially is the last parak. Yes, there's 10 parakim, but the 10th parak is just 3 psukim, which we'll discuss what they're sewing up, as it were. But the real last, real heavy-duty work is right now. So let's cut into the first 3 psukim as a block. So in Tes Aleph 9:1, it says, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, when the king's command and law reached their destination to be enforced, on the day the enemies of the Jews had expected to dominate them, why? Because of the internal and external memos. But it was turned about. Ooh, Nehafuch, it was turned about. And the Jews dominated their adversaries. Notice the Loshon changed from enemies to adversaries. An Ayev versus a Sane. We need to discuss the difference between an enemy and an adversary. We'll have to do that as we go. Constantly happens now through the Pesukim, all the way through the ninth parak. That's a theme that we're going to get clear, please God, to understand the difference between an enemy and an adversary. Verse 2. The Jews assembled in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Who would I think it would be? To cast their hand against those who sought them harm. Now, interestingly, only those who sought them harm were the focus of their aggression. And no man stood up against them, for their fear had fallen upon the peoples, plural, everybody, not just those they're going to attack. Verse 3, all the ministers of all the provinces, officials and governors, now remember, those are the guys that got the internal secret memo and knew exactly what the classified data was from Haman, And those who were appointed to carry out the king's affairs exalted the Jews. How strange, considering they were the ones that read the original memo. Because the fear of Mordechai had fallen upon them. Now look at the end of verse 2. No man stood up against them for their fear. The fear of the Jews had fallen upon the people. But when it came to the ministers, officials, and governors, and chamberlains, they weren't scared of the Jews. They were scared of Mordechai. Now that is an extremely in-depth revelation that the Pesukim are giving here, which frankly, on Purim Day, we just whiz over and not think twice about. We need to try to look at these three Pesukim to understand a tremendous amount of data that's being revealed very, very quickly here as to how this is all summing up everything that we learned in the 8th Perek. Now, in the 8th Perek, we said that the first dispatch that was sent out to the ministers of the provinces contained an explicit order, if you see in 3:13, chapter 3, verse 13, to destroy, to murder, and to annihilate all the Jews. There was a subtext in there written by Haman to kill the children in front of the parents as well. Why? Because when he bumped into Mordechai, who was rejoicing over the Al Tirami Pachad, three psukim that we say after Aleinu, and he was so upset that the children had given Mordechai solace, he said, I'm going to kill the children first. Okay. Now, the masses, they only received a very general public notice that just said, be ready on that day. See chapter 3, verse 14, where we said that. That's all the way back in chapter 3. Now, the ministers were the ones that were meant to supply the details as to what they're really meant to be doing on the appointed day from Haman to everybody else. And that is that the people should do all that was said in the ministers' secret letters to destroy, murder, and annihilate the Jews in verse 13 of chapter 3. And they were holding on. Why were they holding on? Because Haman wanted to wait to the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's Shiva, the anniversary of his Shiva, so the Jews' merit should be at its weakest. Yeah, remember that? And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu got involved upstairs, etc. Eliyahu Navi were told Mordechai about that. There's lots to discuss. We did all that. However, when the decree was rescinded, the king did not want it to appear as if he was reneging on the original irrevocable edict, which was the law of Media and Persia. So he wrote to the ministers under the guidance of Mordechai and Esther, as we did in the 8th Perek. The original edict to annihilate the Jews is still in force. However, what's different? But I got a little caveat for you on this one. I personally, under the king's signet, is now permitting the Jews to defend their life however they see fit, so they will not be an easy target for anyone who wants to destroy, murder, and annihilate them. Now, that wasn't in the original edict. I'm just fleshing it out that essentially there's going to be absolute carnage and massacre in the streets. There's going to be a war in the streets, civil war, Jews against Gentiles. And I'm fine with it. It's like a purge. It's like all laws are being suspended on murder for the next day. Anyone could just go around in the street killing whoever they want. Imagine what a... Think about being a child in the midst of this, if you were growing up in the midst of this, and you knew that mummy and daddy were going to go out with guns tomorrow, and they could get shot, and they could shoot. It's going to be you'd want to run away. You wouldn't want to be in such a place. It's going to be lawless. The king has said, for one day, anyone can murder anyone. Now, the new qualifying text that the king has added to these ministers' private memo was sent to all the people in all the provinces and said even more than that. The original edict said that the people should be ready on that day, but it didn't explain for what. But now Mordechai and Esther were allowed to define the obscure command in any way they pleased. God, you know, Ahasuerus gave them carte blanche to rewrite the memos however he wanted. Amazing. So what did they do? So the Medrash says, quoting on chapter 8, verses 13, not only may the Jews kill anyone who attacks them, but the Jews should be ready on that day to avenge themselves upon their enemy. Now that's new data. They should, anyone that gave them hassle in the street, remember what we said? Today, I'll sell you this fish. Tomorrow, I'll slit your throat and take your money. That's what they were being told in the markets, right? Anyone that said that in any street market knew by king's orders the Jews can come and kill you and everything's fine. No blood guilt, not going to go to jail. They'd be terrified. Now, in verse 11 of chapter 8, it said that the king had permitted the Jews to destroy, murder and annihilate every armed force which attacks them. But that only seems to say self-defense. The new public text that the people had received from Mordechai and Esther said the Jews could even avenge themselves upon their enemies in any way they want, even if they're not displaying any open aggression on that day. I remember you once cracked an anti-Semitic joke against me. I'm going to gouge out your eyes. Now that is something a goy is not expecting. Today it's permitted. The king says so. That's new stuff from Mordechai and Esther. Now we can go and explain what's happening. The Jews said, it was not so poshut what was going on. Let me explain, especially between Shushan and the provinces. The Jews said, we now see that the king's command to the minister that he originally sent in chapters 3 and 8 are contradicting the order given publicly to the people. The first one gave permission only to defend our lives if someone is being aggressive against us. That was the first edict. Someone's come to kill you, you can kill them, and it's completely self-defense, no problem. Now we're getting a new one from Mordechai and Esther signed by the king, that the proclamation allows us to rise up and even kill any non-belligerent enemies. Any goy that gave you any hassle, just go and kill him. Now that's quite different. So they didn't know what to do. Are they still bound by the first edict? Or does the second edict trump the first? Now remember, the laws of Persia and Media are the king's word is irrevocable, which means technically the first edict is up and running. And the first edict said only in self-defense. Now, if you abide by the public announcement that we got today and kill anybody, including non-violent Gentiles, then the ministers will show us the king's order permitted only self-defense against aggression that was sent out in the previous chapters. And that'll cause trouble for us. They'll send back to the king and say, the first one said only, these guys weren't attacking you, you killed them anyway. And according to the first edict, you're not allowed to do that. So when the general populace originally heard the king's order for them to be ready on that day, they understood they should be prepared for the announcement instructing everybody to dominate one particular nation, hence the Jews. Now, since all the nations were intermingled and only one nation, the people of Israel, were actually separately identifiable within the 127 provinces, it was obvious who that nation was going to be. That's a big schus for us, by the way. The fact we were identifiable got us out of Egypt. We're still identifiable, even in Persia. We did not assimilate. Notice when the goyim got scared of the Jews, they immediately tried to assimilate amongst the Jews. But the Jews, even when at death's door, didn't assimilate in front of the goyim. We said that last time. So the Jews' fear would now be intensified if they heard that in Shushan, a law had been issued to destroy Klal Yisrael. So it was a very frustrating situation for them. Can they go and kill anybody they want? Or do they only kill people that are rising up against them? Look now back at verse 2. The Jews assembled in their cities throughout all the provinces outside of Shushan. To cast their hand against those who sought them harm. What does that mean? They were choshesh, they were suspicious, they were careful, they were worried that the first edict was still in effect and they withheld themselves because they didn't know what to do. They didn't want to get in further trouble by going against those who were non-belligerent. And no man stood up against them, anybody, for their fear had fallen upon them because the goyim thought that the Jews might go by the second edict. And all of us have cracked a Jewish joke at some stage. So everybody could get killed. But the Jews didn't know. Was it number 2 or number 1 that's still active? We'll go by number 1. It's the safer route. That's what verse 2 is telling us. All that to understand verse 2. Posh up shut, just basic understanding as to what's going on. Now, seeing that the Jews were not only defending themselves, but actively attacking their enemies, the Gentiles concluded that the updated new version 2 announcement contradicted version 1. And they claimed it doesn't make sense that the first proclamation told the Jewish people to be ready, and the second one tells only the Jews to be ready, told everyone else to be ready to kill the Jews. Now, had the Jews only defended themselves, according to the first edict, the Gentiles would consider that completely legitimate. It's a natural thing to do, and the king is just rubber stamping that. But now the Jews are openly thinking about attacking them in public. Did it change the second proclamation's legality? They're saying that's not fair, because the first edict may still stand. That's the Goyisha view of it. Now, that's the dilemma that the Jews were facing, and it was very worrying. It was very worrying. What's the first fear? The first fear is that regarding the minister's letters, where it says when the Jews' command and law reached in 8:13, that refers to the fact that the king's command contradicted his own law. And the Jews were afraid that the ministers would rise up against the Jews and have them killed for contradicting the word of the king. There's another problem. It says the day the enemies of the Jews had expected to dominate them. That's referring to the original announcement in version 1, which seemed to be a law for the people in general concerning the killing of the Jews. And that's now being turned about. That's what it means in that pasuk, right? Where it says it's being turned about. Look at the end of verse 1. But it was turned about. The Jews dominated their adversaries, where we understood that the adversaries were meant to dominate the Jews. So it doesn't look as if the law of Persian media is actually being properly implemented, and it's going to cause legal confusion amongst the people and the provinces. So that's why the Jews themselves wanted to initiate attacks against their enemies who didn't come forward to kill them. And that was turned. That's a turnabout very much from the first edict. Because according to the first edict, there's no way the Jews could raise up. Now the Jews are raising up, which is the exact opposite of what the first edict was. Now, because of these two fears, the Jews didn't want to avenge themselves of the enemies who didn't rise up against them. And that's why verse 2 says they didn't strike anyone who didn't want to do them harm, because they were scared of what the political and legal fallout may be with those ministers in each province. So that's why it turns out, though, but bottom line, it turns out both fears were baseless. They could have done what they wanted. It didn't really matter. Why? Israel had no need to fear. They didn't know that at the time. They were too worried about the legal wrangling. What they really didn't know about was their fear had completely befallen all the Gentiles around them. That was an act of God. Only God can terrify the Goyim to such an extent that the Goyim dress up as Jews. Okay, that's him doing that. They didn't know, they couldn't count on that. They didn't know that until they saw it. They didn't know that. When no one stood up against Israel, because the Gentiles themselves were terrified, the Jews realized they could act upon the second extract that's been sent by Mordechai and Esther. And that's why it says in 9:5, which we haven't got there yet, that they rose up and smote their enemies. But even those not seeking them harm, they rose up to kill them. Once they said, look, we don't know what's going on. We don't know what the law is. Because there's a, was it the first one? Is it the second one? Don't know. They said, you know, we're going to get our guns and we'll only shoot those people who are going to harm us. That's what you tell the kids at home. That was a decision in the synagogues. That's okay, that's the, you know, the text that everyone was sending about, the emails. Just look after yourself. They went outside and all the Gentiles are terrified of them. What does that mean? The Gentiles are terrified of them because they know they themselves could be killed. Once they saw the Gentiles were terrified of them, they chup that the Gentiles are saying it's the second edict which is true, not the first. Now the Jews can say, look, if the Goyim themselves accept that the second edict is true, we can actually raise up ourselves and go and kill them wholesale, which is what they did in 9:5, which not got there yet. That's the key. They had to see the Gentiles' response to try to divine and figure out what actually the law specifically was. They didn't even know. In fact, neither did the ministers. It was an absolute haywire mess. Nobody really knew what the law was. But God had terrified the Gentiles to such an extent that the Jews made an inference that it must be type 2. It must be the second extract that's doing it. Really interesting idea, which is why we'll see in 9:5. How could they go about killing everyone? Because of what's going on here in verse 2 and 3, that the Gentiles are terrified and they're cowering because it looks as if they've accepted Edict 2. Let's look at verse... Is everyone okay with that? Any questions on that point so far? All right, let's go to verse 4. Now, we've just been talking about how... Remember, verse 3 said, all the ministers of the provinces, officials, governors, and those who were appointed to carry out the king's affairs exalted the Jews, not because of the fear of the Jews, because the fear of one man had fallen upon them, Mordechai. They're now scared of one Jew. Verse 4, why? Because Mordechai was great in the royal palace, and his reputation had spread throughout all the provinces. For the man Mordechai, Ish Mordechai, Ish is always a denotion of grandeur, grew increasingly increasingly greater. Why do I need to know that? What am I getting from verse 4 that I didn't already know from verse 3? The goyim was scared of Mordechai. The high-level ranking goyim was scared of Mordechai. Delete verse 4. No additional data. No additional data. I could have learned all that out from verse 3. Mordechai was great beveis hamelech in the palace, literally in the king's house. Why do I need to know that? The minister's status throughout the provinces, if you were a minister, I don't know, of wherever it was, I don't know, Ethiopia, and you were, I don't know, the head of the mayor of Ethiopia there, that status is incomparable to Mordechai's, because each minister only had covered, only had status and chashivas in their local province. So the minister of Ethiopia didn't have a place in the palace with an office with his name on. He had an office with his name on in Ethiopia or in Eritrea or wherever it is that he was. But at the royal palace, he would be considered insignificant. He's one of the mayors from, I don't know, the provinces. Who knows, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, from the highlands or something, you know? But Mordechai had his own office in the palace. He was of international importance, whereas all the ministers and officers were only of regional importance. The ministers felt compelled to fear Mordechai because God was with him. And they saw that. The goyim saw God was with him. What does that mean? Mordechai vanquished Haman. They all knew that. They all knew what Haman was. And he had a special seat and a special throne. And he was the best of the best, right? Haman was the top minister in all of Persia Media. Mordechai had basically, as far as they're concerned, Mordechai had killed him. And he has now taken over his estate, which was given to Esther, and Esther gave it to Mordechai. See, he essentially is now Haman version 2 in their eyes. He's taken his post, he's got his estate, and he's now the special... Now he's signing the edicts by the king, just like Haman was. Haman had the ability with the signet ring to make edicts. Mordechai's doing. As far as they're concerned, Haman and Mordechai are the same. In fact, they're both prime ministers. Outranked only by the throne. Much like Yosef was outranked only by the throne. Haman was hanged. Mordechai's got his position. The king had released written orders for Mordechai's sake. So the ministers made like a Kal v'chomer argument. They made like a... They said like this. Who was stronger than Mordechai but Haman? And Haman wanted to kill Mordechai. And what happened? Mordechai killed Haman. He overcame... Kol Shekain, all the more so, Kal v'chomer, definitely. If we rise up against Mordechai, we're definitely up on the block. If he could get Haman, think about the complexity of the chess game. Like Haman was like the queen, as it were, the bishop, a very powerful member on the board. We're like pawns. We're like rooks, the cheapest members on the board. He'll definitely kill us. So they wanted to ingratiate themselves to Mordechai. They were scared of Mordechai because now Mordechai is the most important player in the kingdom. So his fame was now, you know, terrifying all the people of the provinces. That's why those individuals were scared of Mordechai. Because essentially, He was kind of like their new boss, as far as they were seeing it. All right, 9:5. The Jews smote all their enemies, as we talked about earlier, with swords, killing and annihilating them. They didn't just kill them, they wiped out whole groups. And with their adversaries, they did as they pleased. Again, it changes from Oyveihem, their enemies, to Besoinehem, to their adversaries. Just, why are you changing the Lashon? Why are you changing the word? It's like a, you know, it's like a noun almost, like, you know, what's going on? It's like this, we've got to talk about this. Now there is a machleg, there's a lot of different discussions on this. There's the Malbim, there's the Rekayach, there's a, I'm going to follow the Al-Shech HaKadosh on this, because there's lots of different ways to understand this. The Al-Shech says that an enemy is a person who keeps his hatred in his heart, internally, without putting that into action. It's not bepoil. It's not happening practically outside of him. It's all in kavana. He absolutely hates you. He's an enemy of you. He wouldn't help you. But he's not doing anything actively to try to get you because he doesn't have an opportunity to do it yet. Now, he loathes you, and an adversary is different from an enemy. An adversary is someone who actually does things to cause suffering to the object of who he hates. The ultimate example of this in the Torah is a malek. Now, the Sukkos David on Parshas Kisetse explains, why is it that out of all nations in the world who have troubled the Jews, only a malek is their mitzvah to destroy utterly, and God himself says, I'm personally at war with them. You know, it isn't as if other people haven't caused us hassle. Why is it a malek is singled out for such intense annihilation? Answer, we never did them any wrong. We never went through their land. We never went to war against them. We never lived among them and maybe caused them, I don't know, they just didn't like us because we were immigrants. We never did them any wrong at all. But they travelled far across long distances just to kill us. Because not of their hatred of the Jews, because of their intense loathing of Hashem himself. After the splitting of the sea, they traversed a long distance just to come and fight with Klal Yisrael. They didn't need to. We weren't going to bother them. We would never go into Amalek's territory. God says, don't go into their territory given to Haseh, to Edom, and their descendants of Edom. You can't put a foot in there, to just leave them alone. They came out of their way to kill us, not because they hated us. They hate Hashem himself. Hashem says, I know that. I myself am at war with them, and you have to destroy them. They are the ultimate quote-unquote adversary in the fact that they take their hatred and manifest it in the most intense way. Haman was an Amalekite. He wasn't a Persian. He wasn't an Median. He was an Amalekite. He was going out of his way to destroy the Jews, even though the Jews had really done nothing directly to him at all. Only one Jew did he ever plaint against, Mordechai, because he wouldn't stand up for him and give him the cover that he wanted. Slaughtering the children in front of the parents is completely illogical to be able to do that, to answer up as to why Mordechai wouldn't stand up for him. That doesn't make sense. That is bizarre. That's psychopathic in the extreme. That's a Malek. That's a Malek. A Malek's the ultimate adversary. But there's lots of adversaries. So when it says that the enemies who only harboured hatred within, some were killed with swords. They injured them. They injured them. You're an enemy. I'll chop you up. And some were killed and some were annihilated. But with their adversaries, who actively sought to harm the Jews, they did as they pleased. These adversaries had wished to destroy, murder and annihilate the Jews. They couldn't wait for that day to come in Adar that had been promised to them. So the Jews now did it to them. And no Jew said, it's enough to merely smite the adversary, you know, chop up an arm maybe. No, the Jews could do with their adversaries what they wanted and they could completely annihilate them. An adversary is a dangerous person. The enemy is a very unpleasant person. The enemy, you can do what you want as well. You can kill him if you want. But the adversary, you're very well advised to do what you want with him. Let's look at verses 6 through 14 as one block. And in Shushan, the capital, the Jews killed and annihilated... Now we're turning to Shushan, notice. Not the provinces. Why? Because things were different in Shushan. Because remember, the whole argument about the first and the second edict not matching up. The first one saying, be ready on that day. Oh, but the Jews could defend themselves. Versus the second one saying, the Jews can actually kill anybody they want. That wasn't the same in Shushan, because in Shushan, the Goyim knew the full extent of the internal memo. They figured it out, we said, from Esther, from Haman, and from Ahasuerus. It was leaked from there. They knew to destroy, murder, and annihilate. There was no change in version 1 to version 2. Excuse me. There's no contradiction into the eyes of the law as to what's happening. When they say they can now raise up and kill anybody, they can raise up and kill anybody. But the first one said that anybody can raise up and kill the Jews. It was much more explicit. They said, we're going to kill the Jews. They know we're going to kill the Jews. And that's the edict. So that's much more complicated. Because the Goyim had a piece of paper saying, we've seen the eternal memo. And now you're telling us for our second memo that you're going to kill us? So what, you just want a riot in the street? It wasn't as if there was any lack of clarity that the Goyim became scared. How are the Jews going to interpret this? This is just a mismatch between the revealed internal memo and now the rewritten internal memo from Mordechai and Esther. Very different. We've got to learn that Shushan was a completely different Purim experience to the provinces. In feel, it was different. There were different things going on. Why? It was the Jews of Shushan that triggered this. They were the ones that turned up to the party and got the rest of the Jews in Shtuch. That was how it happened. So they're going to have a different experience, a not as nice experience. Why? They deserve it. There was 18,000 men that turned up to that party, triggering the whole thing, reminding Hashem, as it were, about the bowing down of the idol in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And then the Yetzer Hara came up and said they've not done full tshuva on that. That's all been triggered by these Jews in Shushan. Who were the, and now we're starting to, right, we're listing some dignitaries. Parshan Dosa, Dalfoin, Asposa, Purosa, all these individuals that they killed. And then the 10 sons of Haman. The 10 sons of Haman, Ben Hamadosa, the foe of the Jews, they killed. So big dignitaries, big anti-Semites, and the biggest of the lot, the sons of Haman, which in those days, I guess, was like the Waffen SS members. But they didn't lay their hand on the spoils. Why not? Why even tell us this? What are those words coming to? What is going on? Lo yishalchu es yodom. They didn't reach out their hands to get the booty. Why do I need to know that? On that day, what day? The number of those killed in Shushan, the capital, came before the king, which means immediately. On that day, obviously the king was personally interested in what was going on in the capital, London or New, whatever it was, Washington, D.C. I wonder what's happening. And the king himself got a number of people that were killed. Verse 12. With that data of how many people had been massacred in the street, Ahasuerus went to Esther. Because it was her plan, right? And he said to Queen Esther, Esther Hamalka, who is now full, obviously, she's the one that's allowed, you know, thousands of people in the provinces, tens of thousands, and hundreds of people in Shushan to be murdered within 24 hours. So she's an important player, this woman now. Mordechai and Esther are now really up there. Remember, the Goyim don't respect Jews until Jews kill people. Where do we learn that out in the Torah? You can have the most righteous Jew in the world. Goyim don't respect anything until you show you can kill people. Where do we learn that out in the Torah? Where do we get a righteous person who should have been respected and wasn't, and then finally was respected when he killed people? Answer: Avraham Avinu. He had set up a hospitality hotel outside Sodom and Amara. He'd been doing acts of public righteousness and kindness for decades. Everyone took him as a kooky old man. Ah, some righteous, like a monk living outside of, yeah? Until the Canaanite kings stole Lot. Then he went to war and he killed them all. Malchay Tzedek came out and gave him tribute. Everyone's like, oh, wow, look at what you did. You took on five nations, a coalition, single-handedly with the yeshiva. Oh, we'll give you tribute. All the kings came to bow before him. Why? Says the Oznayim L'Taira, this is how to show your koyach in the Goyisha world. Doesn't matter how righteous you are, and how good you are, and how godly you are, and how impressive you are in your spiritual endeavor, only once you can kill someone else do the goyim take you seriously. And don't we find that today politically? Really, it's whoever's got atomic weapons that's taken as a world power. Once you show parity, you've got to be taken as a choshever person. Because you could bomb us, right? Ahasuerus now knows that Mordechai and Esther are really putting their money where their mouth is. They're killing members. These are choshever people now. What's he saying to her? In Shushan, the capital, the Jews killed and annihilated 500 men. That means one is they killed them, two is they wiped out whole sects, including even the choshever 10 sons of Haman, all in one night. What must have they only done throughout the rest of the provinces, he wondered to himself. If they've done that in Shushan, under my very nose, he thought it must be much, much worse in the provinces. So what is your request? It shall be granted you. And what is your petition further? It shall be fulfilled. What does that mean? Surely your anger is abated by now. If this is what you want, it's got done. Surely there's no more than this you'd want, is there? Now, Esther, we're going to have to learn this. Esther very wisely understood that Ahasuerus was saying, enough is enough. You've caused enough bloodshed. Call it quits. You've had your request. You've had your petition. I want to go back to normal. Of all the crazy things to say, the most unsuspected response that you would have thought from reading this plain, she said, if it pleases the king, let him permit the Jews who are in Shushan to do exactly the same tomorrow. That's exactly against what he meant. As they have done today, let them go out and kill everyone. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. She wanted the slaughter extended another 24 hours in Shushan. Only in Shushan. I want it longer. You think I've finished? I want it again. Double it up. 100% increase, please. That is something we would never have expected her to say. Verse 14. The king ordered that this be done. A law was enacted in Shushan. They hanged Haman's 10 sons and they went around slaughtering them again for another day. That is so left of field. You would never have thought that would have been Esther's response and that the king would have gone with that, especially considering he was shocked, personally shocked by the numbers of dead in his own capital. It's like, enough already. He goes, no, it's enough. I want to double it up. Hopefully they get more than that. You'd never have thought Esther would have said that. Very counterintuitive. In the provinces, one day of vengeance was sufficient, was it not? But in Shushan, Esther wanted a 100% increase. Why was Shushan different from the rest of the kingdom? Amazing. You'd never have thought. We learnt all the way back, really, from the third and fourth parochim, but certainly in the eighth parak, where we talked about these memos that were being sent, that the letters which the ministers received contained secret orders that the Jews must be completely annihilated on an appointed day. Why? Because of the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's Shiva. And the people were told, just be ready on that day. Remember, Haman didn't want them to get, he knew they were all anti-Semitic, and they get very, very excited at killing the Jews. And once they've got the carte blanche to kill the Jews on one day, why should we wait? They'll go in and kill them now. So he hid exactly what it is they're meant to do until a second memo was going to be sent closer to the time saying kill them on that day. And he just said, just be ready, okay? Just but hold back because I don't want you to miss the ultimate time in Adar to do this, because we've got to hit the end of Moshe Rabbeinu Shiva, which is the ultimate time when the Jews are at their weakest. You've got to kick them when they're down. Now in Shushan, things were different. The edict explicitly declared that the forthcoming destruction of the Jews is on that day, and everyone should be ready for that day, and everyone knows what's going on. And that difference was Hashkocha Protis, and that was punishing the Jews of Shushan because they indulged in a Chashrosh's feast. They were the ones that attended, so they lived longer knowing that they were going to die than those in the provinces. Fair's fair. They were the ones that caused it. When the decree was rescinded in the provinces, the 127 outside of Shushan, Mordechai and Esther only had to issue one public proclamation telling the Jews to be ready to avenge themselves against their enemies on that day. The people in the provinces never really realized that the king had reversed his original decree, which called for the Jews' destruction, because they didn't really understand what was going, because it wasn't clear. But in Shushan, Mordechai and Esther couldn't just say the same thing, because it would make, they knew what they were meant to do. Explicitly, every person in the street knew what they were meant to do, not saying the provinces, only the ministers, the overseers, and the chancellors knew really what was going on in the provinces, but the stomach guy in the street didn't know that. In Shushan, every guy in the street knew what was happening. Because the Gentiles in Shushan would perceive that this ruling is an absolute, complete reversal of the king's original decree, even if they were told that the original decree to destroy the Jews was still in force, and now the Jews were allowed to defend themselves against their attack, the Jews might still have been very scared to take up arms and fight the Goyim. Now, the Goyim in Shushan would assume that the king had remained eager to have the first decree executed and killing all the Jews. And the second decree is only to avoid offending Mordechai and Esther by saying, I don't want to just slaughter them wholesale. If they want, they can defend themselves. But basically, I want all the Jews dead. And that's what the Goyim thought of it. Only in Shushan, not in the provinces. So the Goyim would presume that anyone acting on the original decree is certainly considered to have fulfilled the king's will, because they actually knew it explicitly, unlike the Goyim in the provinces. So the Jews in Shushan decided not to lay their hands on the spoils, demonstrating that they were permitted to kill by the king's order, and all the spoils became the king's property. It's not our spoils, it's the king's, of course, because we're only doing the king's bidding. When the Persians and Medians saw that they wouldn't take the spoils and the spoils became property of the king, even in the Jews' eyes, they knew that the second decree represented the king's will, and they knew they were in trouble. That's why it was so keen for us to be told that they didn't lay their hand on the spoils, because that was the message they were giving the local Gentile population to say, look, it's got to be, that has to be now taken over by the crown. Crown takes all, right? We're just going to kill those, you know, who are raising up against us. But clearly this is the will of the king, and therefore all that property goes to the crown, right? Because it's an actual edict from the king, right? When they saw that they didn't take the money, it must be that government's going to take the money. They'd better be careful. The Jews really can do this. Now, in order to look in verse 11, in order to encourage the Jews and inspire fear in their enemies, the king ensured that the number of those killed in Shushan, the capital, came before him. He wants numbers, a stat, you know, like a guy turns up with a board and says, these are the deaths that have happened. And that showed the people that the king's decree was in force and he was personally interested in the latest numbers of dead. Obviously, he's written it. Obviously, he wants it. And everyone knew that the numbers, you know, people go back and forth, say, what are you doing? We've got to take numbers. We've got to tell the king. He's very interested. Which means that clearly what the king wanted was that the Gentiles be massacred. Now, the Jews in Shushan were scared and they feared their enemies more than the Jews in the provinces. Because the king's reasoning was quite logical. He said in Shushan, the king's decree allowed the Jews to annihilate 500 men, including the 10 sons of Haman. That's what the Pasuk said, right? That means what? If the place where the law was enacted publicly to destroy the Jews dead killed so many Persians, Kol Shekain, all the more so, Kal Vachomer, for sure, where the Jews didn't have to worry about that in the provinces, then what only have they done in the provinces? If they're as worried as they are because the law was so explicit the first time around in Shushan, but they aren't worried about that in the provinces, it must be a bloodbath in the provinces. So he was sure, without knowing the numbers, because they hadn't come in yet, that the Jews must have massacred an enormous number of people in the provinces, because they already did a significant number in Shushan. That's why he went with those figures, that stat, to Esther, to lay that on Esther's table and say, can we call this quits, please? Can we just put this whole thing to bed? I've had enough. Now, the Jews' enemies in Shushan could have claimed that the king's original decree to kill the Jews was still in force. That's the law of Median Persia. You can't go against the word of the king. The masses, the goyim, might then revolt against the king, a public revolution, saying, you yourself have undone the law of Media and Persia, and you're revoking your own decree, which you've got to go. We've got to get rid of you, get a new king. We're only doing your first decree by killing them to start with. That's why the king said to Esther, what is your request? It'll be granted to you. What is your petition further? It will be fulfilled. What's he saying? The masses have begun to fear the Jews because they've seen how Haman was hanged and they've noted my personal interest in those who have been killed and the ascension of yourself and Mordechai. But in their hearts, they're not subdued and they still want to kill the Jews as per the first edict. They might even rise up tomorrow morning to go and kill you people tomorrow morning, especially since the relatives of those who've been killed today would be incited to avenge their people's blood. The Jews have been going around rampaging, killing all the goyim, right? I've got news for you. The sons and brothers of those killed goyim are going to take up arms and in fierce ferocity come out tomorrow and kill you. He wants to avoid uncontrolled riots. He wants Esther to say, no more killing. I'm sated. It's been done. Leave it alone. It's going to turn into a bloodbath in Shushan. I've had enough, says Ahasuerus. In verse 13, completely uncharacteristically and most counterintuitively, Esther Hamalka very wisely answered King Ahasuerus, saying, let the king permit the Jews who are in Shushan to do exactly the same again tomorrow, just as they've done today. And in fact, apart from killing Haman's 10 sons, openly hang them on the gallows and show everyone their dead bodies. That's not what Ahasuerus wants here. He wants an end to essentially a political hailstorm which might evict him from the throne. Esther realized the king himself is the cause of the trouble. The Persians are fearing for their lives because of what the king himself has said and then re-said. The Gentiles' fervor for killing the Jews is going to weaken. If the killing carries on tomorrow, they'll be left with very little to rise up against you or the Jews if we keep weakening their number. The additional day of royal sanctioned killing will calm down the populace's dismay with the king, and they'll realise he knows what he's on about. The edict is definitely enforced to kill the Persians and the Medians at the hands of the Jews, and we frankly want to put up, we just want to give up. Esther realised that. And she told Ahasuerus, the way out of this is not by stopping the killing, but increasing it. The more you show you're behind the Jews and against the Persians in this case, the more the Persians will just give up. They're not going to take you off your throne. They'll actually just put down their arms and call it quits themselves. That's a very clever response from Esther. And that's exactly what he did. He was convinced. Verse 14, the king understood what Esther was saying, and he did her suggestion rather than his own suggestion. But he planned something extra to strengthen the queen's position. Number one, on the very next day, as it says in the Pasuk, he enacted a law, a brand new law, not a decree, not a writ, not a memo, not a statement, a law that the Jews may do on the next day as they had done on the previous day, which was only an outcome of a memo. Then the people saw what had happened on that day, that it had issued from the king as a law, brand new, out-the-box law, and not just for Mordechai and Esther. And the king arranged for Haman's 10 sons to be hanged immediately on even the same day. And it was. A law was enacted in Shushan, and in addition, they hanged Haman's 10 sons. So this really put the wind up the Gentiles in Shushan to actually say, this is an unwinnable situation. The king has now sided with the Jews, making a new law, and he's even showing off the dead sons of Haman to show his siding with Mordechai and Esther, who have clearly taken over Haman's position in the palace. So they know that, that whatever's going on with the first edict and first decree must now be overruled by a brand new law which the king himself has enacted to strengthen Esther's suggestion in the previous pasuk. What we're going to do next time is look at verses 15 and 16, which is where we're going to talk about the fact that the Jews in Shushan assembled on a different day to the Jews in the provinces. And this is where we get the concept of Shushan Purim most clearly, in the fact that the Jews in Shushan really couldn't celebrate on the same day that the Jews in the provinces could. So we don't celebrate Shushan Purim on the same day that the Jews outside of walled cities do, because we've got to be in sync with the difference between the Jews in Shushan and outside of Shushan. And what's going to be amazing next time, and I really mean worth tuning in for next time, is why Mordechai invented the ideas of Matanas Le'evyonim and Mishlach Monas. There's very deep reasons as to what Mordechai wanted to organize here, and he wanted to set up a full-fledged Yontif, like where you refrain from the Lamates Melochas, from the 39, like almost like a regular Yontif, like Pesach, not quite like Shabbos, but like a Yontif. And Matanas Le'evyonim and Mishloach Monos were actually keys to making it a Yontif. Why it didn't become a Yontif, we've got to explain. It was a Chag, where the Jews didn't take on to refrain from the 39 Melochas. But Matanas Le'evyonim and Mishloach Monos are key aspects of that. And we've got to explain how those mitzvahs fit in with what Mordechai was trying to do and how that links in with the second day that was going on in Shushan. So hopefully what we'll do next time is start at the 15th Pasuk and at least get to what? The 27th? Because there's a lot of data that's all happening there as to the establishment of the unique mitzvahs of the day of Purim. So as we can see here, to sum up, what essentially we've dealt with today is the edict being changed over, how that was different in the provinces versus Shushan, how the Jews themselves try to make sense of the change of the edicts, both in the provinces and in Shushan, and how God himself changed the views of the Gentiles versus the Jews, that then the Jews could utilize that to take an additional jump to say we are allowed to take a legal premise there and go with the second edict. Achashosh himself is very much involved with what's going on, and he's monitoring the situation on a blow-by-blow account. He's in the Cobra meeting room, as we say in England, which is a special office which is done like a special meeting room for national emergencies, and he's tallying up the dead, and he's going to Queen Esther on the day and saying, let's call this quits. She says, no, go weiter, do it again. That's the only way you're going to save yourself and the country. And that is indeed enacted as a new law. Once that's complete and the Jews assemble with that, Mordechai institutes new mitzvahs. Brand new mitzvahs midrabbanan. Why did he do that? Why is that so necessary? There's the reading of the Megillah, there's the feasting, there's the gifts that we give, and there's the tzedakah that we give. You can't institute the mitzvah of tzedakah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu instituted the mitzvah of tzedakah. Is Matanas Le'evyonim just a mitzvah of tzedakah, or is it something different? That is a discussion that we have to have. It's not for him to say give tzedakah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu say give tzedakah. So what's so special about Matanas Le'evyonim on Purim? That we also have to discuss as well. I look forward to continuing from the 15th verse with you next time. And I look forward to seeing you next time. In the meantime, I wish you a wonderful Shabbat, a wonderful week in Shabbos. And if there's any questions, now is the time to field them.